Hi, this is Guy Raz from the TED Radio Hour. Before we start the podcast today, we wanted to invite you to give us some feedback. The TED Radio Hour, as you know, is a new program, and we're always looking for ways to improve it, to make it better. So we'd love to hear from you. If you have a chance, check out tedradiosurvey.org. Everything you need is there to answer questions about the show and let us know what you think. tedradiosurvey.org. And thanks. This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR. I'm Guy Raz. One Sunday, 40 years ago, Sherwin Nuland's life arrived at a turning point.
You described a moment that you will never forget. It was a Sunday morning in January 1974. What happened?
Well, on Sundays, we were allowed to sleep late. And breakfast was kept in the little kitchen, and people would just go in and get a roll or a Danish and some coffee. And I was in there by myself, and I thought, I think I'm well enough so that when I start having an obsessive thought, I can just tell it to go away.
Sherwin Nuland is 82 now, but at the time he was 43. And he was brilliant. He was an accomplished surgeon with a whole future of awards and accolades ahead of him. And yet, on that Sunday morning, Sherwin Nuland was in a mental hospital.
And any depressive will tell you that they begin ruminating about things and going over and over and over their self-image, the way someone spoke to them yesterday. Gee, did he realize I'm not what I was? The kinds of things that not what I was. 10, 11-year-old kids did. You know, there's a line on the sidewalk, and you don't want to step on that line, or you hear a sound, and you attribute certain things to that sound that they don't have. And I got fixated on numbers, two numbers, actually. And I kept running into them. Plus, of course, obsessively ruminating about how my life was falling apart, and I seemed not to be able to do anything about it, even though I had in the past thought of myself as a very strong-willed person who had great emotional resiliency.
Sherwin had spent almost an entire year in that mental hospital, and then it happened.
I had always felt, I've got to give in to this thought. I've got to go over it again and again. But now I thought, well, why don't I just blow it away? And I said, I know the formula.
What was the formula?
Well, I don't want to shock your listeners, but if you give me permission, I'll tell you just
what it was. Yeah.
Well, on one of my walks, I had walked over to a service station that was right near the hospital, and I was joking around with a fellow who pumped gas who said to me, you know, Doc, you can get better. Just say, ah, f*** it. And I laughed. But that morning, I thought, ah, f*** it. I can do that. It was very hard at first. It was very hard to drive obsessional thoughts out of my head. But I just determined that I was well enough now that I could control it. And I did that. After that, it was just a few months later that I was out of the hospital. 13 months I'd been there.
And that was it. It was like a line drawn down the center of his personal timeline. And on the show today, we'll hear from TED speakers like Sherwin Nuland, people who now look back on the person they once were and think, who was I? So, what drove Sherwin Nuland to his turning point?
Well, I probably was prone to depression. I had a very difficult childhood. My parents didn't read and write English. They were totally unassimilated. My father had a chronic neurological disease that made life very difficult for him. Why should I call it a chronic neurological disease? He had syphilis, and he was subject to rages for most of my early childhood. He didn't even speak to the other people who lived in the house, my aunt and my grandmother. So it was hard. It was hard for a little kid to understand.
What does electroshock therapy feel like?
Well, actually, it doesn't feel like anything because anesthesia is used. The only thing one feels is the last little bit of consciousness waning rapidly. There's an electrode on each temple, and the current runs right through the center of your brain, yes, and causes all kinds of fascinating things to happen, the nature of most of which we're just uncertain of. As one psychiatrist friend told me, electroshock therapy is the only miracle that psychiatry has.
Take me back to when you gave your talk back in 2002.
Sure.
Before that moment, you had neither written about that or spoken about it publicly.
That's right.
The whole idea of electroconvulsive electroshock therapy.
After I had been asked to do that, I debated for some time with myself, oh my God, should I get up and talk about this? And the more I thought about it over those days, the more I decided I absolutely had to.
Now, why am I telling you this story at this meeting? The reason really is that I am a man who almost 30 years ago had his life saved by two long courses of electroshock therapy. And let me tell you.
I thought by talking publicly, there were probably going to be some people who would be helped by that.
And it was clear that I would need long-term hospitalization in that awful place called a mental hospital. So I was admitted in 1973, in the spring of 1973.
Tell me about what was going on in your life at the time.
Well, I made the mistake of falling in love at first sight, which may work for some people, but it didn't work for me. I was 28 years old, should have known better. And when the marriage fell apart, it was pretty natural, as I think many people do, to blame myself. It was I who was responsible. It was I who was working too hard. It was I who was not giving my wife the proper evidence of closeness and affection. After a time when I sought therapy, I did move out of the house, and that was dreadful because I was completely alone. And the worst thing, of course, a depressive can do is to find himself or herself physically alone. And I found myself giving in to this depression in the sense that I couldn't get out of bed in the morning. I could barely make myself go to the store to buy what little food I was eating. Everything was completely disintegrating. And finally, I reached the point where I couldn't work anymore and obviously had to be hospitalized.
I know you mentioned in your TED Talk that the doctors prescribed the best antidepressants that were available at the time, and they didn't help? Nothing?
Nothing at all, no. So they, all of them, got together and said, this man will have a frontal lobotomy, and that was the plan.
After they made this decision, there was a resident who had been seeing you, and he objected. What did he say to the other doctors?
He said, I know this man far better than any of you do, and I'm convinced that he is not crazy. I'm convinced that he's depressed. And they said, well, I guess humor him. and we'll give this fellow a course of electroshock therapy, which at that time was meant to be about 6 or 8 treatments, maybe 10.
Let me go back to the first time.
Sure.
So you sat down, and they put you out, and that was it.
I lay down, and they put me out, right.
And you woke up and nothing.
Nothing had happened, no. And even after the second, third, fourth, fifth.
Nothing.
Sixth, nothing.
Seventh.
Nothing.
Eighth.
Nothing. I was desperate. Desperate enough to have accepted that lobotomy. Just anything to stop the pain.
Stop the pain. The pain. The pain. The pain. The pain. The pain. What happened at 9?
I don't think anything very much. I must have noticed something. But at 10, I definitely noticed something. I definitely felt there had been a change.
At 11, it got better.
Yeah, 11, 12, 13, 14, yes. A few more treatments after that. I was responding now to talk therapy, and after about 20, was even given permission to go off the campus of the hospital, walk around. And on one of my walks, I had walked over to a service station that was right near the hospital, and I was joking around with a fellow who pumped gas.
It was incredible. I used the term miracle, the only miracle that psychiatry has. And yes, to me, it was a miracle.
Do you see that age as Sherwin Newland before 43 and then Sherwin Newland after 43?
Oh, absolutely, without question. I am a very different person. When I came out of the Institute, I found myself far more open to new perspectives, to the concept of uncertainty, as a matter of fact, living comfortably with uncertainty. I found I was a lot more social than I had been, a lot more accepting of other people. The old curiosity that I had had before starting medical school was blooming, and there was so much I wanted to learn, so much I wanted to know, and to this day, I feel sometimes like a kid in seventh grade, just learning stuff every day and becoming better every day.
Anything can happen to you. Things change. Accidents happen. Something from childhood comes back to haunt you. You can be thrown off the track. There are resurrection themes in every society that has ever been studied, and it is because not just only do we fantasize about the possibility of resurrection and recovery, but it actually happens, and it happens a lot.
Writer and former surgeon Sherwin Newland from his TED Talk. He and his second wife celebrated their 36th anniversary in May. You can check out his entire talk and another one he gave on hope at TED.com. I'm Guy Raz. More Turning Points in a moment on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, turning points. Imagine living two totally different lives over the course of one single lifespan, a life before and a life after. Well, for Rick Elias, the turning point happened in a flash. It was January 15th, 2009. He was on U.S. Airways flight 1549, and the plane was headed right into the Hudson River. Here's his TED Talk.
Imagine a big explosion as you climb through 3,000 feet. Imagine a plane full of smoke. Imagine an engine going clack, 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 clack. Well, I had a unique seat that day. I was sitting in 1D. I was the only one who could talk to the flight attendants. So I looked at them right away. And they said, no problem, we probably hit some birds. The pilot had already turned the plane around, and we weren't that far. You could see Manhattan. 2 minutes later, three things happen at the same time. The pilot lines up the plane with the Hudson River. It's usually not the route. He turns off the engines. Now imagine being on a plane with no sound. And then he says three words, as unemotional three words as I've ever heard. He says, brace for impact. I didn't have to talk to the flight attendant anymore. I could see in her eyes, it was terror. Life was over. And I want to share with you three things I learned about myself that day. I learned that it all changes in an instant. We have this bucket list. We have these things we want to do in life. And I thought about all the people I wanted to reach out that I didn't, all the fences I wanted to mend, all the experiences I wanted to have and I never did. As I thought about that, later on, I came up with a saying, which is, I collect bad wines. Because if the wine is ready and the person is there, I'm opening it. I no longer want to postpone anything in life. And that urgency, that purpose, has really changed my life. The second thing I learned that day, and this is as we clear the George Washington Bridge, which was by not a lot, I thought about, wow, I really feel one real regret. I've lived a good life. In my own humanity and mistakes, I've tried to get better at everything I've tried. But in my humanity, I also allow my ego to get in. And I regretted the time I wasted in things that did not matter with people that matter. And I thought about my relationship with my wife, with my friends, with people. And after, as I reflected on that, I decided to eliminate negative energy from my life. Not perfect, it's a lot better. I've not had a fight with my wife in 2 years. It feels great. I'm no longer trying to be right. I choose to be happy. The third thing I learned, and this is as your mental clock starts going 15, 14, 13, you can see the water coming. I'm saying, please blow up, right? I don't want this thing to break in 20 pieces like you've seen in those documentaries. And as we're coming down, I had a sense of, wow, dying is not scary. It's almost like we've been preparing for it our whole lives. But it was very sad. I didn't want to go. I love my life. And that sadness really framed in one thought, which is, I only wish for one thing. I only wish I could see my kids grow up. About a month later, I was in a performance by my daughter, first grader, not much artistic talent yet. And I'm bawling. I'm crying like a little kid. And it made all the sense in the world to me. I realized at that point, by connecting those two dots, that the only thing that matters in my life is being a great dad. Above all, the only goal I have in life is to be a good dad. I was given the gift of a miracle, of not dying that day. I was given another gift, which was to be able to see into the future and come back and live differently. I challenge you guys that are flying today. Imagine the same thing happens on your plane, and please don't. But imagine, and how would you change? What would you get done that you're waiting to get done because you think you'll be here forever? How would you change your relationships and the negative energy in them? And more than anything, are you being the best parent you can? Thank you.
Rick Elias. More than 3.5 million people have watched his TED Talk.
Hello, London. How are you?
Hello, Washington.
Hello, can you hear us?
Oh, yes, here we are.
So our next story comes to us from Majid Nawaz, who lives in London.
Is that okay?
Just a bit more.
I'm going to be speaking about my TED Talk.
And he runs a group that promotes democracy in the Muslim world. That's now.
So I'm assuming now that anything I say from now on could potentially be used, yeah?
Yes, okay. Yes, yes. So the reason he has to be cautious will become clear in a moment.
Yeah, I do worry. I've grown up worrying and always having to look over my shoulder for one reason or another, so it does come across sometimes as paranoid when people are speaking to me and my eyes are constantly looking left to right to make sure that the coast is clear in case somebody's coming to attack me.
Do you tell people right off the bat, I used to be an Islamist?
Yes, I tell people in a palatable way. I try not to scare them.
My personal story, my personal journey, what brings me to the TED stage here today is a demonstration of exactly what's been happening in Muslim-majority societies over the course of the last two decades at least and beyond. For 13 years of my life, I was involved in an extreme Islamist organization. And I was actually a potent force in spreading ideas across borders, and I witnessed the rise of Islamist extremism as distinct from Islam, the faith, and the way in which it influenced my co-religionists across the world.
I grew up in an area called Essex, which is next door to London. And in the 90s, I mean, again, a lot's changed now in the UK, and so everything I say about racism doesn't necessarily apply so much now. But growing up in the early to mid-90s in Essex, we experienced some severe and violent racism.
C18 are the initials of Combat 18.
There was a group called Combat 18, and this was a neo-Nazi paramilitary organization.
The name is taken from the first and eighth letters of the alphabet, the initials of Adolf Hitler.
When they started attacking us with hammers and screwdrivers and machetes, I began self-segregating because they didn't attack me directly. What they did is, in one instance, for example, they held me back and forced me to watch as they stabbed my English friends because they were deemed as blood traitors for having associated with me. That began a process of self-segregation. And so from around the age of 15, I began associating with what we call here, we refer to as a West Indian crowd, Black British. And I got into a subculture, and that subculture was one of hip-hop in its heyday. In its early days, it was all political rap. We were essentially hip-hop b-boys. We were into breakdancing, graffiti, and the hip-hop music, and there was a certain way of dressing. And we became a very disenfranchised and disillusioned generation seeking an alternative identity.
How did you go from sort of being a hip-hop b-boy to sort of being attracted to Islamist ideology?
So the transition was relatively easy because in those days, unlike today, hip-hop was very political. Public Enemy and various other groups, Brand Nubian, they were espousing a form of black nationalist and politicized Islamic faith. Now, as a teenager experiencing racism at the age of 15 in the UK, it was easy for me to latch on to that.
And he found the perfect place to latch on.
The Hizbut Tahrir organization sets out to radicalize British youth and plans for an Islamic superstate ready to enforce its views by violence.
When he was 16, Majid joined that Islamist group.
An Islamic state across the Muslim world under Sharia law is the central aim of Hizbut Tahrir. There has been much debate about how extreme Hizbut Tahrir is. It insists that it works through exclusively political means.
At the age of 17, I was recruiting people from Cambridge University to this organization. At the age of 19, I was on the national leadership of this organization in the UK. At the age of 21, I was co-founding this organization in Pakistan. At the age of 22, I was co-founding this organization in Denmark. By the age of 24, I found myself convicted in prison in Egypt, being blacklisted from three countries in the world for attempting to overthrow their governments, being subjected to torture in the Egyptian jails and sentenced to 5 years as a prisoner of conscience. By the way, we were laughing at democratic activists. All the way across the world, we felt they were from the age of yesteryear. We felt that they were out of date. I learned how to effectively communicate across borders without being detected. Eventually, I was detected, of course, in Egypt.
So you are in jail in Egypt, and they put you on trial.
And the charge, to quote from the Arabic of it, which I still remember, was tarwij bil qawli wal kitab li jama'atin ghayri mashru', which means in English, propagation by speech and writing for a banned organization. Now, to charge somebody with thought crime leaves the door open for Amnesty International to get involved. So Amnesty then, the moment we were charged, adopted us as prisoners of conscience.
What did you think when you heard that?
That was the beginning of my own emotional transformation. It was the first time in my life that instead of looking over the shoulder for one enemy or the other, I had been embraced by an organization that said, we vehemently disagree with everything you stand for, but we certainly don't think you should have been tortured for it. And because you weren't caught in the midst of any criminal activity in Egypt, we don't even think you should have been charged for it or convicted for it.
So when Amnesty adopted you, that began your emotional transformation. When did your intellectual transformation begin?
That took 5 years, 4 years studying in prison, studying, debating and discussing. I was in prison with the who's who at the time of Egypt's political opposition. That atmosphere, as one can imagine, led to a very rich conversation. And I read lots and lots of literature. I read George Orwell. I also studied traditional Islamic theology. And I eventually came to the conclusion that I had grossly misunderstood Islam. And though I never was really devout and still am not devout, one thing I did come to realize was that I was abusing the religion of my heritage for political purposes. In fact, there's no such thing as Islamic political thinking. Islam didn't leave behind any political ideology and certainly didn't leave behind any system of government.
When you were finally released from prison, you went back to the UK.
Yes, I returned to London, yeah.
Last year, Majid Nawaz was released from prison. 4 years in a Cairo cell.
I rejoined my leadership position on the Islamist organization. It took me another roughly 10 months to come to the conclusion that I actually indeed had no place left on the leadership of this group. And so in 2007, I think I unilaterally resigned my position from the leadership.
Now Nawaz wants to persuade other members of Hizb ut-Tahrir to leave the party and has started to publish a series of papers arguing against the theological basis of Hizb ut-Tahrir ideas.
And of course, what happened when I left was my marriage broke down. My ex-wife remained at the time with the organization. I have no idea if she still is or not because she doesn't speak to me anymore. But she felt very let down because she'd waited all those years for her hero, her Islamist resistance hero, to return, only for him to come and say, well, it was all wrong. It was a very difficult time. My friends turned against me. And they suddenly considered that I was a traitor.
Did you ever go through depression? I mean, did you ever think, my friends are leaving me, everybody's turning away from me, who do I have? I mean, because who did you have?
I was indeed very distraught that my wife left me. When the final divorce came through, I punched a wall. And I actually broke my knuckle. And I was very, very upset, and I had no friends left. I had to literally pick myself up from scratch. At the time, I was sleeping in the back of my car, which was parked on Russell Square in London's West End.
So you're sleeping in your car, and you're doing all this thinking about who you were. I mean, how did that evolve into who you became?
It was very difficult, because whereas joining the group at 16 involved an identity crisis, leaving at, I think, around 29 years old, involved a re-identity crisis. And the best way I can describe it is imagine taking a silk cloth and throwing it on a rose bush and then pulling it off with the thorns tearing through the cloth. But of course, if anyone was well placed to make the Islamist ideology as unfashionable as Soviet communism has become today, which is the task ahead of us, you know, young Muslims need to see Islamism as much as yesterday's news as Soviet communism. Now, to do that, to achieve that, you needed a voice like mine.
And what I believe is missing is genuine grassroots activism, advocating for the democratic culture itself. What we'll have in the end is this ideal that people should vote in an existing democracy, not for a democracy. How does that happen? Well, Egypt is a good starting point. The Arab uprisings have demonstrated that this is already beginning. But what happened in the Arab uprisings and what happened in Egypt was particularly cathartic for me. What happened there was a political coalition gathered together for a political goal, and that was to remove the leader. We need to move one step beyond that now. We need to see how we can help those societies move from political coalitions to civilizational coalitions that are working for the ideals and narratives of the democratic culture on the ground. Because it's not enough to remove a leader or a ruler or a dictator. There is a chance that democratic culture can start in the region and spread across to the rest of the countries that are surrounding that. And we've made a start for that in Pakistan with a movement called Khudi, where we are working on the ground to encourage the youth to create genuine buy-in for the democratic culture.
When you look at the course of your life, do you think, man, I've led two lives. Two different lives.
Three. I was a hip-hop b-boy, let's not forget that. If you catch me walking today, sometimes you can still catch the b-boy bounce in my step, which is quite annoying because it's quite embarrassing.
So how do you define yourself now?
I define myself as a liberal, as a Muslim, as a Democrat, as a Briton, as a Pakistani, as a global citizen. In fact, the antidote to the identity crisis that I experienced when joining the Islamist group I did at 16, the antidote is to say there is indeed no conflict between any of these identities. They're all perfectly compatible. And it's in embracing those multiple identities that I'm able to have a holistic personality.
Is a part of you grateful for the experience that you had as a radical? I mean, how do you reconcile it with who Majid Nawaz is now?
I am everything I am today because of my past, and I've done some things that I am very regretful for. But everything that I have done and that builds up to me being who I am now is essential to have the Majid Nawaz that you have in front of you. So it would be very difficult for me to say that I wish I was a different person.
You had to be that person.
Indeed, it seems to be the case for good or for bad.
That's Majid Nawaz. He's the co-founder of the pro-democracy group Quilliam. It's based in London. His new book about his life is called Radical, My Journey from Islamist Extremism to a Democratic Awakening. You can hear his entire talk at TED.com. Coming up?
Some people say that the bad thing is good. It came from God, and because God is good, the bad thing is good. And I realized that I was in the camp that said this bad thing is bad. And so to deal with it, you've got to do something about it. Otherwise, life is too painful.
I'm Guy Raz. More Turning Points in a moment on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, turning points. A life lived before and another one after.
When I finished high school, I was always a good athlete, but I was small. It was depressing because my father was 6'4", and here I was 5'7", and sort of very slim.
That's journalist Joshua Prager. And around the year 1990, he started to change physically.
Well, I then went to Israel for a year, and it was amazing. All of a sudden, I started to grow and grow, like I was a superhero who finally wakes up and he has these superpowers. I grew about 6 inches. I said, I'm going to do as many push-ups as I can and then add one a night. 30, 31, 32, and then I got to 50, and then I started doing sets of 50. Finally, the game that I loved, baseball, I could finally play it in a way I hadn't been able to just months before. There I was playing basketball, and I went up for a rebound, and my wrist clanged against the rim. And I said, wow, I can jump. So it was all of these things sort of happening at once. The frustrating thing was I had only just come to possess this new body when it was taken away from me. I only had it for like 2 months.
Just 2 months until the day he got onto a bus.
I was looking up at this hilltop out my window, and I was talking about backpacking. We were going to go backpacking. Then all of a sudden, there was this incredible bang. In an instant, everything changed. My head, it jerked back over my seat, and the third and fourth vertebrae in my neck broke. I remember as I flew through the air, my head was bobbing on my neck, and my shoes even flew off my feet. When I landed, I couldn't move.
You knew it right away.
Well, about 30 seconds after the crash, and there was this incredible silence. And then I landed, and then I said, okay, let's go. I realized, wow, you can't go. And that's when I felt vulnerable. And I have never felt invulnerable ever again. The day after the crash, my parents arrived. They flew from New York to Jerusalem. And I couldn't speak. I had to mouth my words, and I mouthed three questions to my mother. Am I going to be able to have children? Am I going to be able to walk? And am I going to be able to play baseball? And my mother, of course, answered yes, yes, and yes, as only a mother would. But I think already I understood then that things would be very, very different.
And here's where Josh's story really begins. In rehab, he started to regain the use of his right side. But emotionally, he was coming to terms with what actually happened and what would happen to him for the rest of his life.
Over the coming months, I learned to breathe on my own, then to sit and to stand and to walk. But my body was now divided vertically. I was a hemiplegic. And back home in New York, I used a wheelchair for 4 years, all through college. College ended, and I returned to Jerusalem for a year. There, I rose from my chair for good. I leaned on my cane and my ankle brace and a backpack on trips in 6 continents. I pitched overhand in a weekly softball game that I started in Central Park. And home in New York, I became a journalist and an author, typing hundreds of thousands of words with one finger. A friend pointed out to me that all of my big stories mirrored my own, each centering on a life that had changed in an instant, owing if not to a crash, then to an inheritance, a swing of the bat, a click of the shutter, an arrest. Each of us had a before and an after.
Do you often think about that day where your life was totally changed?
Well, in the years after the crash, I commemorated it every year on May 16th, and it was helpful. I would put on the cap that I wore in the crash, the baseball cap, and I thought back. I didn't wallow in it. I thought about it, and then I'd move right along. As the years went by, there was a different date that loomed as this incredibly important moment in my life, this hinge that would serve as the before and the after, much like the crash had. And that was the moment when I would have lived exactly as long after the crash as before it. And it wasn't some gimmick. For me, I realized it was incredibly important. Even after I had come to feel comfortable with my disability, there was something that made me feel good about the fact that I had lived longer able-bodied than disabled. There was something comforting about that. June 20th, 2009, at 5 in the morning. I would have lived 19 years and 35 days before and 19 years and 35 days after. Somehow, suddenly it hit me what I wanted to do. I wanted to have a catch with my father, and I asked him if he would wake up at 4:45 in the morning and go back with me into the backyard, and he said yes, and we did. Dawn was about to come, and we had this catch, and I couldn't quite make the plays and throw it back as I had all those years before, but it was a very beautiful moment for me, and I was then ready to cross over to the other side. You know, it's interesting. In science, the term half-life is the term used to describe the amount of time that something decays to half of its value. And what always divides by half will never fully disappear. And that, I realized, is true in my case as well. These things that were a part of me before the crash are still present in me. They're smaller parts of me than they once were, but they're still there.
At a certain point, you decided that you wanted to learn everything about what happened that day. Why did you feel like you had to do that?
You know, it's interesting. I think there are different ways to deal with a bad thing. Some people say that the bad thing is good. It came from God, and because God is good, the crash is good. And I realized that I was in the camp that said this bad thing is bad. And so to deal with it, you've got to do something about it. Otherwise, life is too painful. And what I did was to know the crash. I needed to know everything about it. And so I could exert some agency over this bad thing. And part of that was I needed to learn about all of the people who were involved in it. I found the paramedic who saved my life and the doctors, the passengers in the crash. And the last person was a man named Abed, who was the driver that caused the crash. So I set off to find him. Last year, I returned to Israel to write of the crash. And the book I then wrote, Half-Life, was nearly complete when I recognized that I still wanted to meet Abed. And finally, I understood why. To hear this man say two words, "I'm sorry." People apologize for less. And so I got a cop to confirm that Abed still lived somewhere in his same town. And I was now driving to it with a potted yellow rose in the back seat when suddenly flowers seemed a ridiculous offering. But what to get the man who broke your f***ing neck? I pulled into the town of Abu Ghosh and bought a brick of Turkish delight, pistachios glued in rose water. Better. Back on Highway 1, I envisioned what awaited. Abed would hug me. Abed would spit at me. Abed would say, "I'm sorry." I then began to wonder, as I had many times before, how my life would have been different had this man not injured me, had my genes been fed a different helping of experience. Who was I? Was I who I had been before the crash? Before this road divided my life like the spine of an open book? Was I what had been done to me? Were all of us the results of things done to us? Done for us? The infidelity of a parent or spouse? Money inherited? Were we instead our bodies, their inborn endowments and deficits? It seemed that we could be nothing more than genes and experience, but how to tease out the one from the other? Had Abed not injured me, I would now, in all likelihood, be a doctor, a husband, and a father. I would be less mindful of time and of death, and oh, I would not be disabled. Would not suffer the thousand slings and arrows of my fortune. The frequent furrow of five fingers, the chips in my teeth, come from biting at all the many things a solitary hand cannot open. It was approaching 11 when I exited right toward Afula and passed a large quarry and was soon in Kfar Kara. I felt a pang of nerves. And as I approached the front door, Abed saw me. And I saw Abed, an average-looking man of average size. We shook hands and smiled, and I gave him my gift. And he told me I was a guest in his home, and we sat beside one another on a fabric couch. He'd just had surgery on his eyes, he said. He had problems with his side and his legs, too, and oh, he'd lost his teeth in the crash. Abed then rose and turned on the TV so that I wouldn't be alone when he left the room, and returned with Polaroids of the crash and his old driver's license. "I was handsome," he said. We looked down at his laminated mug. Abed had been less handsome than substantial, with thick black hair and a full face and a wide neck. It was this youth who on May 16, 1990, had broken two necks, including mine, and bruised one brain and taken one life. Abed then showed me a picture of his mashed truck and said that the crash was the fault of a bus driver in the left lane who did not let him pass. "I understand," I said, "that the crash was not your fault, but does it make you sad that others suffered?" Abed spoke three quick words. "Yes, I suffered." And it was then I understood that no matter how stark the reality, the human being fits it into a narrative that is palatable. He was not a particularly bad man or a particularly good man. He was a limited man who found it within himself to be kind to me.
There was much I wished to say to Abed. I wished to tell him that were he to acknowledge my disability, it would be okay. For people are wrong to marvel at those like me who smile as we limp. People don't know that they have lived through worse. That problems of the heart hit with a force greater than a runaway truck. That problems of the mind are greater still, more injurious than 100 broken necks. I wish to tell him that what makes most of us who we are most of all, not our minds and not our bodies and not what happens to us, but how we respond to what happens to us. This, wrote the psychiatrist Viktor Frankl, is the last of the human freedoms to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances. But most of all, I wish to tell him what Herman Melville wrote, that truly to enjoy bodily warmth, some small part of you must be cold. For there is no quality in this world that is not what it is merely by contrast. When one morning, years after the crash, I stepped onto stone and the underside of my left foot felt a flash of cold, nerves at last awake, it was exhilarating, a gust of snow. But I didn't say these things to Abed. I told him only that he had killed one man. I told him the name of that man. And then I said goodbye. Thank you.
It's kind of a weird question, but does a part of you feel lucky?
You know, it's interesting. I do believe that I'm lucky in a sense that I was born with whatever mental toolbox it is that enables me to respond positively to adversity. But I think that most of us have that. And I think that we don't realize we have that until we're in that situation and we're called upon to use those tools. A lot of times people who know me, they talk about what a lucky man I am. Things always work out for you, they say. But maybe they're responding to the fact that I'm a happy person and my life is a great life. I wouldn't change places with anyone, least of all Abed, who caused the crash. So I do think that so much of life is how we respond to it. And I'll tell you something. I always had that hilltop in my mind. And last year when I went back to Israel, I said, you know what, why don't you go see where this damn place is? I went and I found the exact road, which I'd been looking up at the time of the crash, and I looked back. And what was amazing was I could see where I had been heading when I was approaching this round in the bend. And I could see where I was supposed to have continued. I know that I didn't go get the pizza that I was off to get that day for lunch, and I know that an arm and a leg were taken away from me. My left side doesn't work well. But I don't know what else would have happened had I continued on. What hit me also, what was wild, when I was looking down at that bend, it didn't look so steep from where I was peeking down. When I was in the bus, it seemed like a really steep descent, and that sort of rough embankment was actually now filled with almond trees. And it just hit me, God, we need distance, we need perspective to look back at something honestly.
Journalist Joshua Prager, he lives in New York. His memoir is called Half-Life, and you can see his full talk at TED.com.
There were two roads I could travel. One led to wealth, the other.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. If you missed any of it, or if you want to hear more, you want to find out more about who was on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many more TED Talks at ted.com. You can download the show through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Portia Robertson-Migas and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
When you grow old, my purse is full. Still I'm